Today's talk will not be about high-TC superconductors, or maybe a little bit. Usually I give talks about high-TC, but we have several other programs going on in my group or had over the past years, which are related more, or turned out to be related more to heavy fermion systems. And you will learn from this talk how that is. Work that I will talk about today is partly by van der Eptes, where I start with. Mena is a PhD student, Kuzmenko, Molochev and Pressura a little bit. Also work in collaboration with Shen and Friedman in Stanford University. And then with various other people, Zanon and Nusinov have helped us inspire with some nice ideas about... Oh, there's a pointer, yeah. But there. I don't see it. Oh, here it is, yeah. Okay, yeah, it's good. Okay, Zan and Nusinov have helped us with discussions on the Coupe rates, but also more in general on optical properties near quantum critical points. And then Kessley and Manofsky have provided the samples that we'll see today. So the outline is, I'll talk about alpha cerium, gamma cerium a little bit. Then we'll talk about power laws. In fact, I will probably not well, I'll stick to this order. We'll talk about power laws of sigma omega in high-TC superconductors, then spectral weight transfer in iron silicide, and then power laws that we recently found in manganese silicide. This here is the it's a complicated picture. You can look very long at it before you recognize all the features, but these are photoemission and inverse photoemission spectra of alpha and gamma cerium. You probably all know that alpha and gamma cerium have the same crystal structure. They correspond to the low and high temperature phase separated by a first order phase transition of the simple FCC, the phase center cubic structure of pure cerium, differing only in volume quite considerably by 15%. So this is the low temperature phase with the volume collapsed phase, and that's the high temperature phase. What you see here is essentially density of state measured with inverse photoemission and photoemission. These inverse photoemission data come from Yves Beer, and these photoemission data here were recently measured together with Ziyech Shen and Stuart Friedman, Jeroen van der Epp. You should actually, for the purpose of this talk, ignore these huge peaks over there. As you can see, those huge peaks the position of those peaks depends on the type of photon source you use. And actually, those are not density of states features, but they are Auger peaks. And there's no time to explain that in detail, so you better ignore those. But if you look at the helium-2 spectrum or at the XPS spectrum using high-frequency photons, you see that there is a nice density of states close to the Fermi energy, which peaks near the Fermi energy. And then there's another sharp peak at the Fermi energy, and then a second higher energy peak in the unoccupied side of the density of states. And these bands here are hybrids of the cerium-4F bands, or not really hybrids, but they contain both cerium-4F character and cerium-5D character, where the 4F character is the most confined in space, and the 5D is believed to form relatively broad bands, which could be as wide as, say, 10 electron volts. And the 4Fs are then have always been believed to be responsible for Kondo-type physics in these compounds. Now, the thing which distinguishes these helium-1 spectra from things that have been shown in the past by other groups is that they are quite different if you compare the gamma phase and the alpha phase. You'll see that the gamma phase is a prominent peak sitting over here, which has been attributed to the F0 final state. So it's actually the one electron removal state from the 4F part. And then this is the one electron addition state for the 4F shell. And the energy between those two states corresponds to the Hubbert U for, in this case, for cerium, or an effective Hubbert U, which is something like 6-7 eV wide. Now, also you see a very important difference is that that in the alpha phase you have a very strong peak sitting here to Fermi energy. And that's, of course, a thing that people working on dynamical mean field theory like a lot, because that would correspond to the Kondo-type peak or the resonance that you always find in dynamical mean field calculations. And indeed, it is much stronger in the alpha phase than in the gamma phase. indicating either stronger hybridization or maybe a slightly different occupation of the 4F level in the two compounds. If you then go to the optical conductivity, as shown over here, again alpha and gamma phase, this is a scale now of around 2.5 electron volt up to this point. There is an extra peak here at around 1 eV for the alpha phase, which is not so strong or maybe even absent in the gamma phase. And you see that as you go into the Drude direction, or what we may call Drude, you have significant differences as well. The alpha phase has an additional shoulder over here, followed at lower frequencies by a steep rise, and the gamma phase doesn't have that shoulder. It may look as if it goes down a little bit, but that's just noise. So it actually tends to separate at low frequencies, which we could not reach in this particular experiment. It had something to do with the fact that samples had to be evaporated in situ and so, and that allowed us only to measure above a frequency of around 200 inverse centimeter, allowed by the particular windows needed for the experiment.
Do you have derivative of this?
Sorry?
Derivative.
The first derivative?
Yeah.
Well, I will not show you first derivative, but I'll show you the 1 over tau plot, which is maybe serving what you want to see.
The photo emission data in the previous slide were also on the IL and your data.
Yeah. Except the inverse photo emission part, that was just copied from a paper by Yves Beer.
By who?
Yves Beer.
Oh, okay.
It's very old data. Here you see a blow-up of the low-frequency part up to about half an electron volt, a little bit more. Again, you see very clearly now that the gamma phase has a broader Drude-like peak, and the alpha phase has the beginning of what seems to be a narrower Drude peak, followed by the shoulder over here. And this...
What would be the DC value of this?
Well, for the alpha, it's hard to tell, because it's still rising.
But you can measure the resistivity.
True, but I mean on these films it hasn't been known. I mean, these were quench condensed films,
oh.
So the DC resistivity might not be as good as it can be if you make really pure crystals.
But it's really but nice to have, because then it gives a clear idea where that peak is trying to go to.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, it could be a little bit tricky, because if you have a somewhat amorphous film or polycrystalline film with weak grains in it, then in the high frequency part it would actually follow the bulk behavior. But then as you go to the microwave, you'll see all kinds of dips and peaks which have to do with the, so before you reach the DC value. And that's not real intrinsic behavior anymore, but it is confusing.
All I'm saying is just to gauge whether this, I should really believe that curve, it would be nice to know where is the DC value,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
as to be able to ignore all the things you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, don't do that.
No, but the question is, if it's known, for alpha and gamma,
it's a measurement, yeah.
But for crystal, it's known.
It is known. In fact, it depends, again, very strongly on purity. Alpha cerium is a very complicated material. If you just cool down gamma, theoretically, it would have a nice collapse.
What temperature is this?
But what actually happens is the crystal fracturizes.
What temperature is this?
The gamma phase was deposited and measured at a little bit about room temperature, 400 Kelvin. Alpha phase was deposited and measured at 20 Kelvin. So these are, this is a quench condensed film, and this is just an ordinary film.
There is another phase in between, right?
There's a better phase in between. So that is the reason, to avoid that phase, you like to evaporate your films right at the temperature where you want to measure them also.
So you get rid of that.
We believe that we get rid of that.
Well, also, there were claims that possibly there is some small symmetry change across the alpha gamma boundary. I mean, is that settled or?
It's not settled. Yeah.
There's a theoretical paper by your colleague Eli Ashburn, and there is some experimental work going on in England.
Yeah, but it has not appeared. And
it has not appeared.
And the rumor is already 2 years old, so I don't know what's the status of that. But it could well be. In fact, I would strongly believe that it should be slightly different in symmetry, just electronically. What we then did is to use the generalized Drude conductivity formula to analyze this a little bit further, so to figure out what the meaning of the shoulder is that you see in the alpha phase. or what could be the meaning in any case of the shoulder. And that's just by replacing the scattering rate in the Drude formula by a frequency-dependent scattering rate and by introducing a frequency-dependent mass. And doing it in this form, you will get 1 over tau and the m star over m formulas by simply taking the real and imaginary part of 1 over the conductivity, multiplied with an appropriate constant, which is frequency-independent. And that means that you could also think of this as another way of plotting the same data. And it's not really theory yet. It's really just replotting a data. But if you do it, if you represent it in this way, you will find that gamma cerium has a gradual rise as a function of frequency in its 1 over tau. And the alpha cerium also has that, but then it appears that there is a saturation of the scattering rate. And if you look at m star over m, it's a little bit outside, and it's still the m star, which you can see here. You see that for the alpha phase, for the gamma phase, m star over m is more or less constant. It's around 6 times an electron mass, which is not totally unreasonable if you have band electrons. And for alpha phase, it starts at the same value, but then if you go down in frequency, you see the gradual rise of this. And that behavior of, especially of the alpha phase, maybe it is a little easier now to optically extrapolate that value also. But it is consistent actually with a very old idea for heavy fermions by Sulevsky et al, who said, well, 1 over tau in a Fermi liquid should be characterized by only one particular energy scale and one coupling constant. Coupling constant reflects the coupling of the electrons to each other, or to the to each other essentially. And the other scale is just the Fermi temperature itself. And if that is the case, then you should find a 1 over tau which rises quadratically and then saturates at high frequencies at a constant. And this further rise, which we see over here, may be just the fact that you start to mix in higher interband transitions. And that is quite a nice, attractive picture. You would say now that, okay, on a high energy scale, the alpha and the gamma phase behave more or less the same. The gamma phase never manages to form this heavy or intermediate mass Fermi liquid, but the alpha phase does so, and it happens on a scale of around 0.1 electron volt. And that would be then the typical energy scale of forming the Fermi liquid. That does not, it's not orthogonal to the Martin Allen Kondo picture, but it's just a different way of representing that. Now we switch to a completely different compound, where we're going to do similar type of analysis. This is bismuth 2212, a cuprate. This is measured along the AB direction. I should add that in all these measurements that I'm talking about, we are using ellipsometry in the visible part of the spectrum and reflection experiments in the low frequency part of the spectrum, shown here. And we use the ellipsometry to improve the determination of the phase of the reflectivity in the low frequency part, allowing us to get better and more precise values of the real and imaginary part of sigma. But in other sense, it is just the same as other people measure. So here you see the real and imaginary part of sigma. They are, again, roughly Drude-like, as you would expect for something that that conducts very well. This particular plot is still in the normal state, just above TC. But again, you can apply this generalized Drude formula, as has been done by many people before us, and you will find that 1 over tau now rises essentially, well, at least it starts out linearly, and then it bends over a little bit, although you could also argue that this is not linear anywhere, this always slightly bent. An m star over m, as a function of frequency, again, it rises to a higher mass as you go to lower frequencies. And this, of course, is the behavior that a long time ago already was embraced by in particular by Varma and collaborators as evidence for what they call marginal Fermi liquid behavior, in which 1 over tau was postulated to be linearly proportional to frequency itself. So in that model, it should be really linear over here. It shouldn't bend over. And the m star over m should indeed have this gradual rise, as we observed there. But I like to emphasize that what we see here is not precisely linear. That's something I'm going to get back to.
And compared to the alpha-gamma cerium, was qualitatively similar, and I just forgot what
no,
was the
no,
difference.
No, it is completely different. You see, here you have this saturation at higher frequencies,
yes.
And we don't have that in the case, or it happens more
but
gradually.
But you have the linearity. I love.
Well, but love this,
range.
Yeah, you will always find. I would say this is probably something that starts out like this, right? But you can't really tell whether that is linear or not at the moment. You really have to go to lower frequencies. Judging from the frequency dependence of the mass, I tend to believe that this thing really likes to saturate below this frequency range, and then of course Vanoff et al. Would do the same.
That is still a little puzzling because if I remember correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, but the TK, the estimated TK for the alpha phase is in the scale of a few thousand Kelvin, right?
2000 to be precise.
Right, 2000
yeah.
Kelvin. So yeah. That's about 1000 centimeter minus one.
No,
it's
more
than 2,000. Yeah, 2,000 also. So we are.
So what would maybe expect omega square in that region? Why do you see linear?
You would expect the half width at half minimum to be that value rather than where it saturates, yeah.
No, but I'm saying, I mean, we're arguing that it would bend down in a thermally liquid form at lower temperature.
Uh-huh. That would be a much lower scale, yeah. But I wonder.
Why? That's what I don't understand.
Oh, why am I arguing that this would bend down at lower? Well, simply because M star over M appears to go in that direction.
Why would that happen at much lower scale?
I have no idea. And I think that this thing that was derived by Martin and Lennon, 2000 Kelvin, was just a scale for their particular experiment. They did not base any prediction for the optical connectivity on that, but I would argue that scale is not so different from the scale. What is the definition, or what is the typical scale of something that has this bell-shaped form? Well, that would be this omega f over here. That's the half width at half maximum, and that in this case is 1300 or so inverse centimeter, which is actually quite close to the Coma scale.
Would indeed be a few hundred Kelvin, but then for a few hundred Kelvin,
not a few hundred. One inverse centimeter is about one Kelvin.
Yeah.
So it's about the same scale. A centimeter minus one is a Kelvin.
No, I understand actually. The problem because if the scale is indeed something like 300, 500 Kelvin, then usually gamma value or packet mass is larger than 15. In your case, it's up to 15 and.
Yeah, yeah.
It's usually larger packet mass, larger gamma value.
Yeah, but
for gamma value, for the value of packet mass, it's indeed rather a couple of thousand Kelvin.
But isn't that what we have here? I don't see now the disagreement.
I'm just building on the point of Gabi, which is that he observes that this curve is roughly linear, and you're saying it's a formula which is quadratic. That's my question.
Okay, I maybe should have put a fit to this because this, in my opinion, this is just a Lorentzian, and it is actually correct.
Oh, sorry, I'm looking at 1/tau.
Well, you have a bit of an error bar over here. I mean, I have no difficulty with saying.
It's an omega square.
Yeah,
that,
right.
That's
yeah.
Right.
I just don't see the omega square.
Yeah, I don't really
okay.
See it.
I don't see it either, but but I do see a sufficiently large error bar to say that, okay, if this is omega square, yeah. Okay. Well, you don't have to see an omega square there. I mean, if you fit it differently, it's fine. Okay. So another way of looking at the frequency dependent scattering rate is not by 1/tau of omega, but it is a thing called 1/tau star. It's often favored by experimentalists because, in the previous expression for 1/tau. We still had to, in order to get this 1/tau, we still had to multiply the imaginary part, sorry, the real part of 1/σ with some arbitrary constant, omega p square. That constant you do not need if you calculate 1/tau star, because that's just frequency itself times the real part of sigma over the imaginary part of sigma. So it's more parameter free. But it comes with a penalty. This is really 1 over tau times m star over m. So it's more remote from a physical frequency dependent scattering rate. Nevertheless, you'll find it often in a liturgy plotted in this way, you will find that 1 over tau star is perfectly linear with frequency. And that is very, very often observed. It's actually not very often discussed, but it is very often observed. Now, what does it mean to have 1 over tau star precisely linear with frequency, apart from little bumps, of course, which sometimes are phonons and sometimes things that we don't know exactly what they are? It actually means that the ratio, real part of sigma over imaginary part of sigma, this ratio here, are constant because of the frequency factor which we have over here. So that means that the phase of sigma is a constant, and rather than stating that you just have linear frequency dependency over here, it is actually more interesting now to find out what precisely the constant is and see of that if that can be distinguished between one model or the other. But already I should say that in the margin Fermi liquid theory, 1 over tau star itself should not arise precisely linear. That should be a little bit superlinear, and 1 over tau should be linear in that model. So we have something slightly different here. Now, you can actually argue, one line of argument that would lead to this constant phase is the following. Suppose that we would have a time scale invariance of the optical conductivity, in fact of any function. That also would imply, by virtue of Fourier relations, that also the frequency dependency would also be a power law, would be time scale invariant. But if that is time scale invariant, then the only form it can actually take is that of a power law, as indicated over here, I omega to some power, times a factor which still may contain a phase. Now, what has this phase to be? That also is something that you cannot take arbitrary, because in the absence of external magnetic fields and so on and so forth, sigma omega has to obey time reversal invariance. And that means that sigma omega has to be equal to the complex conjugate of sigma minus omega. And if you just combine this property or this boundary condition on this constraint on this form of sigma together, you will find that phase in this expression has to be zero, identically. And that means that the time scale invariant conductivity, or frequency scale invariant conductivity, should always be a power law times a real constant, where the power is a power of minus I, or just plus I, it doesn't matter, but let's say I omega. Now this was originally derived, or postulated, or sort of derived, in the context of spin-charge separation by Phil Anderson. And this is, of course, exactly the behavior that we saw before. It also tells you what the phase is of conductivity, which then has to be a constant. It tells that the phase of conductivity should be related to this exponent eta as pi over 2 minus pi times eta. Another thing that follows directly from here is that this exponent eta is not only visible in the phase of conductivity, but it is also visible as a power law of sigma itself directly. So eta can be determined in two different ways, and that you can use as a consistency check on the analysis or on the validity of this model.
Yeah, sorry, maybe I didn't hear your first sentence. Time the first scale invariance. What does your first equation mean?
Ah.
What is P?
Okay.
To me, this would be a constant.
That would be a constant. So if you multiply frequency with a factor.
Some factor.
So you scale up. Yeah. So if you, this is actually the same as saying that you scale up your spectrum over a certain scale p.
Right.
Then it should again be the same spectrum apart from a multiplicative constant.
So if it was a constant, this
would be true. Yeah. No, it's not always true. It's not automatically satisfied. It's only satisfied if you have an. You can actually take. Well, the only form that satisfies this is a power law. There's a particular relation between P and lambda.
What is lambda? Is it real or what?
That could be in principle a complex function, but it has to be subject to this constraint
is
here.
Is P just one number, or would it be an integer?
It can be any number, but for any type of scaling that you have, it has to have a particular value. sorry, no, there's a fixed relation between P and lambda for any type of scaling that you have.
I mean, this could be, if you guys did a omega like K, then this could be a block wave with P were translation and lambda was ETI 5.
Right, if it were a block wave. But of course, this is not a block wave. Yeah. Yeah. So, is clear?
So that's one example of what it So P could be on integers.
No, no, a block wave would not satisfy this scaling invariance. I mean, if you take e to the power I kx as your block wave, and you multiply k with a certain factor, then...
Translated.
No.
This
is multiplying. Yeah, that's scaling. Yeah.
Okay.
So I can go on?
Yes.
Okay, so here we show now this phase angle. Measured experimentally. Never mind the straight line, we'll come back to that later. Also shown is the best fit I could get to this phase angle of this compound using marginal Fermi liquid theory. And for that I had to adopt, I mean it has a number of parameters in there which you can adopt. That's the, as close as you can get. So, it is a little bit outside the error margin, but not very far. But if you look at many data like this, you start to realize that it is really not exactly the same form. Another check that we could do is to take the sigma absolute, and I've made the best possible fit only to this part of the spectrum. Because if you go to lower frequencies, here you start in a superconducting state to notice the effect of opening of the gap, and at low temperatures, in the non-superconducting state, you may sometimes start to pick up effects of a pseudo gap or something like that, but above 1,000 you are safe. Also, there are phonons here. All that is absent in this part of the spectrum. And if you just fit that, you get again a value of eta, which here is about 0.2, and that is very close to what we have over here. In fact, this solid line would correspond to taking eta equal to 0.19. So here we have now a collection of all the data, where, again, I indicated the phase that you get by choosing eta to be 0.19. You find that for all these temperatures, from 50 up to 300 Kelvin, you indeed have this constant phase. But then if you go below, well, it would say roughly 1,000 inverse centimeter, clearly in the superconducting state, you have an enormous shift of the phase, not surprisingly, because it becomes more inductive now, the type of response. And for the other temperatures, well, what that precisely is, we don't know. It's it could be an indication of a pseudo gap, in any case, it's not in the scaling part of the spectrum anymore. So here we have a collection of three different samples now. For the three different samples, you see that for the optimally doped sample, you have this constant phase behavior, but for the underdoped and the optimally doped and the overdoped samples, the phases are become now frequency dependent and precisely in opposite trend. So you see a nice trend here going from underdoped to optimally doped to overdoped, that first of all the phase has a positive slope versus frequency, is constant here, and has a negative slope. And if you compare this phase value to the value which you get from fitting the absolute value of sigma directly to get an exponent from there, then you also see that it only fits very well, it only matches very well for the optimally doped. And again, there is a trend as versus doping, that first it lies below the phase measured directly, then it is the same, and then it will lie above the phase measured directly. So this is, of course, a very tentative plot. We have three points here, but we know the TC of these samples. We do not know exactly what the doping is, but at least you can make a plot now of the TC as a function of our parameter eta, where eta is best defined for optimally doped, and here you already noticed that these fits are not perfect anymore. Maybe another thing I should remind you is that the trend is apparently that if you go overdoped, it goes more in the direction of a Fermi liquid. For a Fermi liquid, eta should be precisely zero, and for a very far underdoped, you get a different situation where the sample simply does not conduct anymore. But that is possible. You can achieve that by taking eta equal to 0.5. In fact, it would mean that your convectivity is just constant versus frequency.
An underdog may do some strange thing, but overdog, if it's indeed thermolytic, you don't simply approach thermolytic behavior, because you said that it should be zero, but it should be constant. It's without any slope, right? Or slope. It's even a stronger slope for overdog regime than for underdog.
Yeah, that, I don't know. there is one. Okay, so if you really want to massage, but I don't like to massage this. If you want to massage this, you would of course start to say, well, we have more oscillators. I don't like that particular approach. There's one other thing that may save the story, and that is if you go back to to this model, for example. I'm sorry, no, I'll show another and better one later on. That's here. Yeah, if you did I skip anything? Oh yeah, here we have three more examples. If you consider the phase angle as a function of wave number in more realistic models, now what is that? First of all, you could take a real Fermi liquid model with a Drude peak where you have a finite bits in the Drude peak. If you have that in that type of model, the phase angle will actually rise gradually from 0 to 90. And maybe we are starting to pick up that behavior where the phase angle starts to rise gradually versus frequency. It's just it has to rise because, in fact, it will only be constant for frequencies far above the sketching rate itself. Now, another thing is that the phase angle at very low frequencies must always start at zero. And we know that at very high frequencies it must become 90. These are just consequences of Cramer-Kronig relations and so general relations for the conductivity. So in order to have a sort of constant phase anywhere in the spectrum, you can only have this for a short while, and at some point it will have to drop in some way or another, and will have to rise in some way or another at high frequencies. There's no way to avoid that. Which is actually also one of the reasons why, if you look at these expressions by Anderson and by Farman and so, for the marginal Fermi liquid or the Luttinger liquid models, they always put bounds on their formula. There's a lower bound and an upper bound, and you're not supposed to use, sorry, in the case of Anderson, there's a lower and a higher upper bound. In the case of Varma, there is an upper bound, and instead of a lower bound, there is a sort of ugly non-analytical point where you say, for frequencies smaller than temperature itself, you get a different behavior. It becomes Drude again. But that would do a thing like that. It would have to drop. The phase has to return to zero. So there's a limited region of anomalous response, and one of way of extending this power law formula, which I mentioned before, would be in the following way. Instead of just having minus I omega to some power over here, you would have to add a frequency-independent scattering rate to that. And doing that will satisfy that, will cause the thing to cross over to a zero phase at some point. And in order to save the high-frequency limiting behavior, you would have to add the frequency-dependent term over here, which simply recovers the not yet reached phase in the plateau region if you have a power 1 minus 2 eta in the denominator by putting I omega to 2 eta, multiplying that with I omega to 2 eta, plus some constant omega, but this has to be sufficiently large. So if you make this something of the order of 1 eV or 2 eV, then you will have a plateau until you reach 1 or 2 eV, and below you will have, and this will provide you a lower limit on the plateau value. That was just okay. So now we move to.
Can I go back just to your formula once more?
Yeah.
Because it's ignore the first one we had. I just want to see what eta is at about 5.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Okay, now one non-Couperet example that has been discussed in the literature, but I don't want to talk very long about this one, was by Dodge and Orenstein and others, in the case of strontium ruthenate, which has a ferromagnetic phase transition at, I think it was 50 Kelvin or approximately, or 80 Kelvin. And they observed that in the ferromagnetic phase, at low frequencies, the phase versus frequency measured now with terahertz spectroscopy also seem to saturate. I mean, it started at this value zero, as I mentioned before, but then as they increase frequency, this phase seems to saturate at a plateau value. They don't quite reach the plateau value, but again, that plateau value does not correspond to 90 degrees. It is some lower value. And from that, they inferred that this material would have an anomalous non-Drude response, again, at low frequencies. Now, Strunz-Meruznevate had one problem, or has one problem. It is a relatively dirty system, at least if you use films, as they did. I mean, they had to work with films because of the need to work with large samples at low frequencies. And apparently the residual scattering rate of these films was quite large, so that has been later criticized a little bit by McKenzie, saying that, well, this could also be explained just from the high residual scattering in these samples. So I'll come to another example at the end of my talk, manganese silicide, where the scattering, which is much cleaner, which is extremely clean material, not having this problem. And nevertheless, properties like these. Manganese silicide is a member of the class of transition metal monosilicides. Transition metal monosilicides come in many different structures, but the particular variation, the particular structure that I like to address today is the structure found in iron silicide, manganese silicide, and all the red transition metals indicated over here, combined with one silicon. It has a simple cubic space group, T4P213, which contains four equivalent transition metal atoms and four equivalent silicon atoms. In fact, you could say, okay, the transition metals are the blue ones and the silicons are red, or vice versa, because they occupy equivalent positions. So this is the unit cell containing eight atoms. Each of these atoms has a similar or even the same type of surroundings. And if you just place yourself at the center of one of those atoms, you will find that it has seven neighbors, not exactly at the same distance. There are slight variations in distance. So actually, it falls apart in two groups of three and one separate, where this single atom has the shortest bond length. But the bond lengths do not vary very much. And maybe an interesting peculiarity of this structure is that it does allow you to arrange the atoms in a way that all these seven bond lengths are exactly the same. But nature doesn't choose it this way. Apparently, there's a reason. Chemically or in chemistry, there must be a reason for this bond to become shorter. And I think that is maybe an important thing to notice in considering the electronic structure also, that this might be a completely saturated bond, whereas the other ones are not completely saturated. So anyways, we're going to talk about this guy and that guy over here. Now, the iron silicide has a long history now. It started all with Epley and Fisk about, I think, 10 years ago, a little bit less. And I'll show you our results only, but I'll come back to their results later on. They did reflectivity experiments on iron silicide. These are now our own reflectivity experiments, but they look more or less the same for different temperatures. It's not indicated over here. The red curve here is the low temperature phase. That's about 4 Kelvin. The blue curve corresponds to 300 Kelvin, and the other one, the green one, is in between. I think it's 150, if I remember well. And already from the reflectivity, you can see that this here is a metallic response. It extrapolates to 100% reflection at low frequencies. Whereas in the low temperature phase, that doesn't happen. You see that there is a suppression of reflectivity over here. And, well, it's a little bit hard to see, but the reflectivity really doesn't go to 100% here. It stays at a 0.75 level. And there's a lot of additional structure in here, which is due to phonons. So that's an indication of the formation of a gap, and this here looks a little bit like an ordinary semiconductor with a not too large gap. What we also did, in addition to a reflection experiment, is to do ellipsometry in the visible part of the spectrum to get temperature-dependent, very precise, real and imaginary part of the dielectric constant. Again, later I'll show you Kramers-Kronig analysis of all these results together, and it's good to remember that having ellipsometry up to an energy of 4.5 eV, where you know from which you can calculate reflectivity and phase, that helps enormously to to pin down the phase in your effectivity which you get from Kramers-Kronig relations. It makes that part of the analysis a lot more free of errors. So this here is the conductivity now after Kramers-Kronig analyzing the part up to 6,000 wave numbers, and then what you see above 6,000 wave numbers is then measured directly with elipsometry. It's all done now as a function of temperature, and now the temperatures are indicated. So you have 10 Kelvin, 50, 100 Kelvin, 150, 200, and 300, and you may say that below 300 Kelvin, almost immediately, there's a evolution of the spectrum in the direction of a gap. It's an interesting coincidence that this gap has the same frequency as the gap in YBCO. And when I first saw these spectra appear with Zach Schlesinger's name on it, I thought, well, maybe there's a problem with his spectrometer, because no matter what he puts in his spectrometer, he always finds the same gap. Of course, that's not quite fair to say, because the reflectivity spectrum looked completely different, and that is what he measured, and indeed, it is absolutely a correct gap. Now, the thing that they noticed, and it is still very hard to see on this log scale, is that the spectral rate, which is being removed over here, apparently is not recovered anywhere else in this spectrum. And that is what you would should observe if the gap would be of the ordinary semiconductor variety, of the garden variety in semiconductors, where you simply change a little bit the hybridization between bands, and where then in the density of states you would start to open a gap. You would immediately say all the spectral weight would be recovered immediately above the gap in that case. But that doesn't seem to happen here at all. I think there's a lot of additional structure in here which is up to today not completely understood also. Then we have very nice sharp peaks, and those are phonons. They have anomalous phonon strengths, and in fact the story of the phonon strengths of these oscillators, of these phonons, is in itself an amazing story. If you just integrate out the oscillator strength of the phonons, you can make an estimate of what the effective charge is on iron and silicon. And you should keep in mind that iron and silicon, all irons and silicons are equivalent here. So in fact, if you do it, you would find the charge between 4 and 5. It slightly depends on temperature also. That would mean that you would have iron 4 plus or 5 plus and silicon 4 minus and 5 minus. Now, just from the Pauli electronegativities of this compound, we know that iron and silicon are essentially neutral. I mean, you can get not more than 0.1 charge on it, and maybe even just zero. Moreover, it's more covalently bonded material. It's not at all an ionic crystal, let alone one with a very high ionic charge. But it turns out that this can be understood in terms of a picture that is called resonance. Was first introduced for iron silicide, also for this compound, in 1948 by Linus Pauling. And the phrase resonating valence bond really has its roots in that 1948 paper. What physically happens is not even so difficult to understand. Imagine I am this iron atom and I have silicon neighbors left and right. Now I have non-saturated bonds with the silicon neighbors. So the bonds are, say, a little bit less than half filled. Now, these are optical phonons where the iron shifts a little bit relative to the silicon. What happens? This bond here becomes stronger, and that one becomes weaker. So you start to pile up more charge in this bond here and less over there. So actually, as the iron moves around, the charge moves around over larger distances than the iron itself. And because charge is light, has a very small mass, it contributes very strongly to the optical spectral weight, much more, if electrons are very light. So they contribute much more to the spectral weight, because the spectral weight is proportional to density divided by the mass, much more than the ions itself. And that is the main reason why, if you just have this type of coupling between electronic bands or electronic bonds and ionic motion, that the ions may pick up an enormous amount of spectral weight. And that's what happens in these phonons. That's sort of a separate story, but it already tells you that this compound has that covalency plays a very important role in the physics of these compounds. In fact, you find exactly the same behavior for the phonons in the neighboring compounds, manganese silicide and cobalt silicide, which otherwise have quite different low frequency electronic properties.
And coming back to the spectral weight, I mean, you don't really see clearly in this figure that the the weight of this
I'll show you a better plot for that part. Yeah, so I was now talking about the phonons. The next plot will have a better plot on that.
What is the point you're stressing on the phonons? The temperature dependence or the sharpness?
No, the strong oscillator strengths in these phonons. They have a lot of oscillator strengths in there. It's very hard to see from here. But if you analyze the oscillator strengths, you get you would get an ionic charge of 4 or 5 plus, which is obviously unphysical.
But is it temperature dependent or not?
It is the temperature dependent also. Yeah.
That's also unusual.
It's unusual, but it should not completely surprise you, because as a function of temperature, these electronic bands are actually shifting through the phonons.
Right.
Yeah. And apparently, the physics of this arises from coupling between the phonon and these electronic bands.
So you would say that the Born charges in this material are anomalously large,
right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But yeah, if you take the carboxides and so on, what are the Z-stars and the...
Of course, it is more complicated there because you have many more different ions. But there you can simply take advantage of the fact that the oxygen is the lightest one, so that contributes most to the phonon spectral weight. And you get maybe 2.3 or so for the charge, not more than that. For the C-axis. Now, for the in-plane, that hasn't been analyzed sufficiently precisely yet. So here is the plot that you would like to see. And here we have the integrated optical conductivity for different temperatures, which is often called the effective number of electrons. So this is the 10, 15, and 300 Kelvin. At the 10 Kelvin, if you integrate sigma, of course, there's a gap over here, so it takes a while before you start to pick up the spectral weight, and then it starts rising almost linear because the conductivity doesn't have very strong variations in this range. Now the blue and the red curve start to rise immediately, and the blue is essentially a constant conductivity, and you can see that up to 2,000 wave numbers at least there is no recovery of spectral weight. What would happen if you would pile up the spectral weight immediately above the gap is that this black curve would then return to the blue curve, but it stays below. Now we expand the scale a little bit, a lot actually, to 45,000. Now it's much harder to see that the spectral weight is never recovered, nowhere in this plot. That is the 10, but of course the room is small enough that you can probably see it on this distance, but I'll show you a better plot again. So the next plot I'm going to show you is the same set of curves where I simply subtracted the black one for many different temperatures to show you that there is no recovery of spectral weight anywhere in the spectrum, up to 4.5 eV. So 10 Kelvin, of course, is 10 Kelvin minus 10 Kelvin curve gives us a zero. And then you see that you have these horizontally going lines. Now the error bars have been pessimistically estimated here. So the fact that you have within the error bar no recovery at all in this range just tells you that there is no recovery in this spectral range at all. And so it has in a way become worse, because the original claim of Schlesinger, I think, was just up to 10,000 of a centimeter, or maybe 15, I forgot. But now we see that it is not even recovered up to 35,000. So that's the histories, like Schlesinger and Maple and Apley, etc., wrote this story up to 1 eV, it was apparently, in 93. That was later questioned by DiGiorgi, Grüner, and others, saying that the sum rule might be recovered at about 0.4 eV, but the error bars are very large. Then Damascelli, in his thesis, just using the same technique, still refutivity in Kramers-Kronig, said, it's not recovered up to 1.25 eV, but we didn't publish that because we first wanted to have the ellipsometry. And having the ellipsometry, we know now that it is not even recovered up to 4.5 eV, and that is the status of the story. So now we have to go to the synchrotron and do it there to find where this spectral wave goes, because it cannot disappear. It has to go somewhere. Now, I like to remind you of, I like to propose to you a picture that, I constructed a few years ago for the electronic structure of iron silicide. If you look at the iron atom itself in its local surrounding having this threefold symmetry, you will find that the d-band split up in three groups, one or just one separate state is the lowest one, and then two groups which are doubly degenerate. And if you now start to fill up these states, and now it depends how many electrons you like to put on the iron, but I like to put 8 electrons altogether on the iron, then you would have one set of electrons in a separate higher set of doubly degenerate states, e.g. states, which may not couple very strongly to the surrounding. But I must say the evidence I have for that from the electronic structure is very thin. On the other hand, if you just look in the band calculations, you do find a set of very narrow bands near the Fermi energy, and they are of D nature, so apparently it just comes out of band calculation, but I find it hard to understand exactly why that happens. Now, if you just put 8 electrons on the iron, you have 4 more to put in the silicon bands, and if you, again, looking at Matthes' band calculations, you find that the 3s are split off quite far, so maybe you can just leave those or consider those as completely filled shells. But still, you have 2 electrons, 2 other electrons to account for in the valence bands. And so that's crudely depicted that you have. You have silicon type states, which nevertheless are hybridized strongly with the iron D states, presumably with these ones. So they're of mixed character, 2 electrons in there. And you have 2 localized electrons. And 2 localized electrons together can form a localized moment of spin equals 1, G equals 2. As you indeed find in the susceptibility at high temperatures. On the other hand, if you go to low temperatures, well, we saw on the optical spectra already, there's the opening of a gap, and indeed, the susceptibility is very strongly suppressed and becomes zero eventually at low temperatures when this gap opens. So, yeah, the major task is to find out what precisely is the physics of this here. Is that Kondo physics, or is it something else? Is it band physics? That is, but certainly strong correlations play a very strong, important role here. Otherwise, you would not find these local moments in this material.
Where can you get Kondo in the picture?
Well,
you would be spin parallel, or
you could get Kondo if you would assume that the coupling between those would be very weak, and just treating those as isolated moments, you would have a spin.
Would they form spin one, or what?
They would form spin one, and that can be precisely compensated as you need in a Kondo insulated picture by 2 electrons in the valence band. In principle, that's possible.
What are the 2 columns? The cartoon is not clear to me.
So these are silicon, mainly silicon type bands, and these are mainly silicon P bands, and these are mainly the iron 3D bands. But I have already pictured in that there is a bit of mixing between the bands here.
So you think that the hybridization is weak in this compound?
For this particular one, it is weak. So there's one set of d orbitals which is weakly hybridized.
Right.
All the other ones are strongly hybridized.
Right. Okay.
It's maybe a lot of interband transition at low energy, no? I mean, from P to B.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. It's not true. Yeah. So, a lot of the spectral waves that we see in the optical spectra are P to D transitions. Yeah. Or I would say all of it, because D to D is essentially forbidden. So that's always very weak.
Yeah, is it obvious that those antibonding bands are not lying higher than the non-bonding?
Yeah,
so that the four electrons are all sitting in this non-bonding localized guy. Is it obvious where the gap is from Matthes or whoever's calculation that you shouldn't put your 2 flat dots in the right-hand side or in the box on the left-hand side?
To put those over there?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you said the same thing yesterday.
Sorry.
<It's> maybe. I haven't figured out this. Yeah. Then you get a completely different story, of course. Then it's pure D
states. Right. So that's why I'm asking you, why do you put this? Because somebody said it should be like that. Or
yeah, sure.
The measurement feels.
No. It's because the original picture proposed by Schlesinger and Epley was that of a Kondo insulator, so I tried to picture it in a Kondo insulator. There's a second argument, and that is going at very high temperatures, you do observe a spin equals 1 local moment for every iron. And that would be certainly consistent with the high temperature phase being having just 2 electrons in a localized state there. So, So this would then be the picture of what happens. You have again the silicon valence states, valence electrons, and in hot iron you would have a spin equals one local moment for every iron, and then as you cool it down, eventually you'll reach a state where these electrons here are precisely antiparallel, forming singlet, I should say, singlet combination with the irons themselves. Now, at least that may that certainly would give you a spectral of weight, a spectral weight transfer, and maybe of the type that we observe. Namely, if spins are antiparallel, as indicated over here, you should realize that the physical process which causes the antiferromagnetic Kondo coupling between those electrons is virtual hopping of the electrons of the valence states onto the irons and back. And now it depends a little bit on the balance, because you have also virtual transitions from the iron to the silicon and back. And now it really depends on where the Fermi level is in this picture, which one is dominant. But assume for the moment that the dominant one would be where these electrons move to the iron mostly and then back. You would have a virtual occupation in the low temperature phase of the iron 3D levels, which is higher. In fact, it goes in the direction that you just said, actually, which is higher than in the high temperature phase. Now, this opens a possibility for the spectral weight of those electrons to escape sideways, as it is, so to speak. The electrons residing on iron have a different optical spectrum, a completely different optical spectrum than electrons which reside in broad valence states. In broad valence bands, you will have a strong Rudder peak with relatively strong spectral weight. It can be gapped, of course. Whereas the iron electrons would have dominantly transitions from the 3D to the 4P and the 4F states. Now, the 4P is a set of very broad, essentially free electron type bands. In fact, so broad that you will never be able to see the end of it in an optical spectrum. You don't even reach that in an optical spectrum. And the 4Fs are well separated from the 3D states, again by 8 or 10 electron volts above the Fermi energy. So moving electrons at low temperatures into this state, moving them more to the iron atoms, would actually result in loss of spectral weight in the valence band and build up of additional spectral weight in these very high energy transitions involving transitions starting at 3D and ending at unoccupied states elsewhere. And that may very well be what we are observing. And I realize now from the discussion we had yesterday already and from what you also said, that maybe this is not even real Kondo physics, that one should really say that this is not virtual hopping, but real hopping of those electrons to those states. And that would make it a lot stronger even, of course. The effect would be a lot stronger. But that needs to be analyzed more in quantitatively. Now I'd like to go to manganese silicide.
This should be pretty common phenomenon, like this, because probably you can think of many other systems in which something like this, maybe not due to quantum, but the distribution between the band and local electron takes place, and then it should be also some application in optics. Do you know of any other systems with similar properties?
Well, we have seen things like that in sodium vanadate, actually. Again, it was still quite a simple effect.
I remember but there were some data by Gordon Thomas about a similar problem in V2O3, I think, that also there was a change of spectral weight, and spectral weight moves to really high energies, actually.
Well, that's a generic feature of strong correlation.
Yeah, that's what I remember.
But the funny thing is that it doesn't even have to be strongly correlated. If you would have just molecules, a set of molecules with, say, p orbitals in the ground state like this, and you're using light which is polarized this way, right? Now you will have higher states like these, to which you can, with this polarization of light, to which you can make excitations. It would give your optical spectrum a nice excitation with this energy difference. Now suppose there is another P state split from this one by, let's say, a crystal field, a little bit higher in energy, which would be like this. And this is the energy scale, right? Now this one certainly can have a transition to the S state over there, but only for light polarized in this direction, but not in this direction. So if this would be the ground state, now you just warm up the sample a little bit, and you start to partly occupy these states here, you will lose the spectral weight in this transition. And there's not even correlations involved. And that's why what I meant with escaping sideways. They simply move to a different state with different symmetry properties. It's more dominated by symmetry in this case than by correlations. I mean, it's just a thing that we shouldn't forget. If you have more than one set of orbitals involved, that there may also be non-correlated explanations for this sometimes.
Well, there's a very easy way to distinguish its mechanisms, which is by studying the polarization.
Yeah, in this case, yes. Yeah.
Because the reason why the transfer spectral weight is so central to strongly correlated electrons is because you're saying that new states are being created.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, in the case of a molecule, you know what all the states are. Just some are active and some are not active. Now, all you have to do is change the polarization and check if the spectral weight changes or not.
Yeah. That's true. So in the case of iron silicide, there's not much you can do with polarization because it's cubic, so it's optically isotropic.
So it's due to correlations?
I guess so.
You cannot distinguish it in that way. You can ask the Wiggly suit.
No, you can't, right? Because for this phenomenon to take place, it should be polarization dependent.
Well, to give you just one example, I just gave you one example where correlations do not play a role.
But I would like you to do all possibilities. For all the polarizations.
Mm-hmm. I think what I'm trying to say is this. If you see huge transfer spectral weight, one has to be careful with the implication error that it implies automatically strong correlations. There may be more trivial explanations. You really have to think about the details also.
This line cannot distinguish. You have these molecules oriented in, say, four different directions.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I understand, if you put light on them, you cannot distinguish. If you could put it on one single molecule instead of all these different ones,
then you can. In this example, you can solve it by studying polarization. And maybe in other examples where you suspect it is non-correlated, but some more trivial, you can always find ways of establishing that. But it probably depends on the details in each case. Yeah.
In iron silicide, there are many other experimental agents that the correlations play a very important role. Right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
With aluminum.
Yeah. No, I think there's no question about it that it is a very strongly correlated system. Yeah. Now, manganese silicide is. In contrast to iron silicide, manganese silicide is more metallic. As you cool it down, resistivity drops. You can see it has a somewhat peculiar temperature dependence, actually, which is sublinear. And then as you go through a phase transition at 34 Kelvin, here it becomes helically magnetic. The helix can be easily unwound with an externally applied magnetic field to make it completely ferromagnetic. It's just a Tesla or so. And there you get more, and actually it is precisely quadratic behavior. You can't see it here, but I'll show it later. It is really T-square behavior. So on the basis of experiments like these, you would probably say, okay, this is the Fermi ligature regime that we have, and this is some other regime, possibly non-Fermi liquid. Another feature about manganese silicide is it is an extremely clean material. You can see that the residual resistivity must be really low here in this material. It is one of the cleanest strongly correlated systems that I have seen so far in studying these materials. It's even better than most cuprates. So another thing is that if you apply pressure to manganese silicide, you can tune it to a quantum critical point where this transition temperature drops to zero. And in fact, beyond that quantum critical point, you find always a T-linear behavior. So here it is more like the square root or so, but then it becomes T-linear in the resistivity. So it is close to a quantum critical point, and unfortunately we cannot do the optics with this the precision that I'm going to show you under pressure, but I would like to do that. Now, I'm going to confuse you completely about this later on. It's very confusing.
Yeah, is the structure of this material the same as
There's four manganese. Again, it has the seven neighbors and all.
And one of them is shorter than the others.
One of them is a little shorter than the others, yeah. Again, you have these strong phonons in the optical spectrum,
At high temperatures, what's the susceptibility like?
The susceptibility crosses over to, at very high temperatures, you have to go to, I think, 800 Kelvin or so, you will find Curie-type behavior with a spin of approximately 2. And as you cool down progressively, you see that, well, actually, it's just not Curie-like. If you fit sections of it, you may find as small as half, even.
So you don't know what is the valence of manganese at high temperatures, really?
No, it's a strange puzzle, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Optical conductivity, again at high frequencies, has a set of interband transitions coming up here. At low frequencies, at 200 Kelvin, shown over here, you see that it is a little bit flat. In fact, not so different from iron silicide at 200 Kelvin. But now, as you cool down, it does the opposite. The conductivity starts to rise. And, well, I mean, you see strong wiggles over here, but these very strong wiggles are just noise of the analysis now. So it becomes a little bit more Drude-like. But not really Drude-like, as we will see in a second. Again, we can apply the frequency-dependent mass and 1 over tau analysis. And here, now you see that, well, this is this 300 Kelvin curve, the 100 Kelvin curve. As you cool down, you see that, again, this mass has this nice rise to higher values as you go lower and lower. Also shown over here is what the fit produces with this M star over M for lower frequencies. It goes to above 40. Now, fit normally doesn't mean too much, but this fit was actually guided by the DC resistivity values on the same sample. And it's actually not possible to get any other fit not showing this enhancement of the mass if you believe the DC resistivity values. If you now look at 1 over tau, starts out roughly linear at low frequencies, and then it bends over at higher frequencies. And that linear behavior persists to very low frequencies. Again, if you just look at the DC resistivity value of 1 over tau, you see that you really have to extrapolate this linear behavior, or a little bit sublinear behavior, to get there. And there's no sign of this becoming constant at low frequencies. And that is surprising, because here we are at very low temperatures where the resistivity has T-square behavior. And if you looked at that on the same scale, or maybe I think I've been told that you should always compare pi times frequency, you should always compare frequency this pi times temperature. And if you do that, all the pi times temperature would for these curves would be really in this range already. Clearly in this range. So that's puzzling, and I'll show you more puzzling things later on that that we can't place. It's very strange. We also looked at the reflectivity. These are grazing reflection curves. We also did this normal reflection. Grazing reflection has the advantage of giving you a lower reflectivity, further removed from the 100% line, so experimentally it is just easier to follow the trends as a function of temperature and frequency that way. And what we do know is that for an ordinary metal, the reflectivity should have so-called Hagen-Rubens behavior. Hagen-Rubens behavior means that the reflectivity goes like 1 minus a constant times the square root of frequency. So if you take this formula, you would need beta to be half. Now, I showed you that at high temperatures, the resistivity had this funny non-T-square behavior. It has a funny crossover, this bending over. But that's precisely the region where we find beta to be half. Here we have fits to the reflectivity curve directly, and you find that beta is nicely half, a little bit higher. But only if you go below the phase transition, you see that beta drops. So these curves that are square root-like become straighter. And so that's another direct way to see that something is strange is going on with the power law of sigma. It's not explainable as an ordinary Drude type of behavior. Well, I'm going to skip this, actually. You can ask me later about it. But we again try to fit this formula over here, in particular the low frequency part of it, which has only two Well, actually, through three fittable parameters, the plasma frequency itself, the exponent, and a sort of generalized scattering rate, although it's questionable how you should interpret that parameter now. It's not an ordinary scattering rate. So shown here are again reflectivity curves and the ellipsometry curves with the fits, and the next plot will be the fit parameters. So here you have the most important fit parameters are actually the gamma, that's the generalized scattering rate, and eta being this exponent. And again, you find this exponent that we have to fit is 0.2. For a Fermi liquid, it would have to be 0, because we find 0.2. And so it's a little bit like the Coupe rates, an effect that exists down to the lowest temperatures. We also find that the scattering rate itself starts at very low values, at low temperatures, and then it rises to much higher values. And well, that seems to be the best fit we can get.
There are no anomalies at this condition temperature. The resistivity you very clearly see the change, but in all these curves, it seems to go quite smoothly.
Yeah, it goes quite smoothly. Yeah, yeah, you don't see it very clearly. Yeah. Here is an attempt to do the fitting with an ordinary Drude model for different temperatures. This is high temperature, and this here is the lowest temperature for Kelvin. So all these curves here, they're and the black dots here correspond to the DC resistivity values. So at high temperatures above the phase transition, just fitting a Drude peak, you extrapolate correctly to the DC resistivity. But as you go below the phase transition, the extrapolation simply doesn't get there. It's impossible. We tried very hard. It is impossible to fit this with a Drude model. It simply doesn't work. You can do it by putting in many more oscillators. But of course, putting in many more oscillators introduces a lot of fittable parameters, and in the end produces a curve that just looks like this non-Drude form that we already had.
So the DC resistivity is larger.
Is the DC resistivity is.
The activity is smaller. The activity is larger.
Yeah, it's larger. Yeah, yeah.
And is this fit down there including, say, impurity scattering, something like that?
Sorry, what kind of scattering?
Impurity scattering or something like that. There may be also at very low temperatures, resistivity itself is very low, and then maybe the minute.
Yeah, this was. Well, that's. Yeah, that is included here. Yeah, that's included here. Yeah. It's included as just part of the width of the Drude peak that you fit to.
Yes, did you say what the nature of this phase transition was?
Yeah, it's from paramagnetic at high temperatures to helical ferromagnetic at low temperatures. Here we have the fit, not using Drude, but with this other form that I showed before, so which has these three fit parameters, and there you see that there's no problem at all to fit directly to the DC resistivity. So that's a very puzzling situation. We have in the temperature range where the DC resistivity is T square, more Fermi liquid-like, the optical spectra don't seem to be Fermi liquid-like at all. At least if we are allowed to associate Drude with Fermi liquid, and maybe that's the dangerous thing to do. That is what everybody always does. So that is more or less the end, I think. Oh yeah, there was one last thing. So we had this generalized scattering rate gamma. Now, what is this gamma? Just from the formula in which it was placed, this formula here, you can already see that gamma enters in the DC conductivity now with an exponent, right? If you make omega equal to 0, then gamma to the power 1 minus 2 eta, which is gamma to the power 0.6, that would be what normally would be the scattering rate. But gamma itself, which has units of 1 over second, is not really an ordinary scattering rate, or should not be taken as the scattering rate, or maybe that should be taken as the scattering rate, but then the scattering rate would not immediately give you the DC resistivity. So there's a strange twist here. Connection is not a usual one.
With this formula, is there any justification for this, or is it simply just fitting formula? Or you can obtain it in some...
It's the two slides that I skipped. So, what is the justification? The only justification I can give you is this. You know that if you want to do something else than ordinary Drude, and you don't know, and without having a microscopic theory of what one should precisely do there, you know that you have to satisfy a number of constraints. For example, based on thermodynamics, we know that the real part of sigma must always come out to be larger than zero. We know that you have to satisfy a causality relation between the imaginary and the real part of sigma. You have to satisfy time reversal symmetry. It has to satisfy an epsilon rule telling you that, say, the integral up to infinity should give you the number of electrons in it. And the DC limiting value should correspond to rho DC. Now, those are the only constraints I think you have. And those are all satisfied with this formula. Of course, you can find more formulas that satisfy these constraints. But it is a very economical way with very few parameters to get away from ordinary Drude, get different power laws, with just one parameter extra, which is this parameter eta compared to Drude. That's the justification. But microscopically, I think one has to look for justification in terms either of scattering processes. You're scattering probably by, or you're coupling very strongly to the magnetic modes, and maybe the magnetic mode spectrum has some special features that it would still be possible, I think, in terms of a Fermi liquid model. But I don't know what to do about this dichotomy between seeing T square in the resistivity on the one hand and a different exponent for the frequency dependence. But maybe it is also not at all like that. Maybe you really should think in terms of, say, more revolutionary ideas like non-Fermi liquid. Now, that is the final experimental graph. Here we have again resistivity versus temperature, just to show you that it has this T-square behavior. And here we have the fitted gamma. But I didn't plot gamma, I plotted gamma to the power 1 minus 2 eta here to show that this gamma, if you plot it with this exponent, indeed is proportional to T square. But if you would take out this exponent 1 minus 2 gamma, you would to eta, you would find that gamma itself is not proportional to T square. It has a different power law. And that is just a big question mark why that will be this like this. But the same oddity was also observed by Orenstein and Dodge in the case of strontium ruthenate, another ferromagnet. And this seems to establish their observation just in a different material. So we have at least two examples now of this behavior. So the summary is as follows. Alpha cerium is a Fermi liquid with a mass of around 15. Gamma cerium is just a bad metal, probably because you have strong scattering by the local moments there of the 4F shell. High-TC superconductors at optimal doping have a power law where sigma is proportional to I omega to the power minus 0.4. This is wrong. There must be a zero here. Minus 0.4. The phase of sigma is 0.3 times pi, independent of frequency in the mid-infrared range. And, okay, that's just the same as saying for both cases that the exponent eta is 0.2 in this case. Iron silicide has a gap spectral weight, which is transferred beyond 4.5 eV now. And manganese silicide at low temperatures has that rho of T is proportional to T square, but sigma of omega for frequencies corresponding to the same temperature is roughly a minus 0.5 power law. And that was all I had to tell. We had all the questions already.
We just have a question. I mean, if this spectrum is dominated by the interband transition at low energy,
of which compound? No?
Iron silicate.
Yeah.
Does this make sense? I mean, does it do the models for describing the low frequency part of the spectrum?
You mean manganese silicide? Yeah. Or iron silicide?
No, iron silicide.
Well, I didn't really use a Drude model there, did I?
Manganese silicide.
Manganese silicide. There, did. Okay. So that is, I would say, the low frequency part is not interband transitions at all. No. That is definitely intraband. I mean, we're talking about frequencies below 10 milli electron volt now. And that could hardly be interband, I think. If that were interband, then...
Yeah, some calculation band, obviously.
I don't think the band structure has been calculated, but if you just take a look at the band structure of iron silicide, for example, you will find that band splittings are always more of the order of a tenth of an EV or so. Yeah, one tenth, 0.1. Yeah. But also, if you would have interband transitions, you would see a lot of structure really as a function of frequency where the interband transitions begin. And these are all very smooth curves, so I don't think that would be the proper assignment.
Is this Hill's Q base, is it commensurate or not?
I don't think so, no. No. It's incommensurate. In fact, you can continuously stretch it in an external field also. Yeah, no, it's not commensurate. No.
May I make a comment on power loss and optical connectivity? The glass people have done this. It may be a comment of a gravity. So the glass people have done this since 50 years. And as far as I know, the theoreticians have gotten nothing. So it's fun that you feel experiments, but doing the power loss, it's perhaps nothing but perhaps a theoretician to see what's going on. But another thing,
what would you recommend instead?
just plot it as it is and try to fit it into a real part and an imaginary part. And, say how it starts for low frequencies, how it goes for high frequencies. That would be more helpful for a theoretician than just have this power. Hmm. Or what you try to do is to fit a whole spectrum with the single power. And for instance, if you have these power laws and make a strict transformation, you may be in trouble because it's ill-posed in some sense.
No, no, I think I mean,
it depends on the degree how important it is.
In general, I agree with you that power loss would not satisfy Kramers-Kronig relations, which is why you have to make these smooth extrapolations at higher and lower frequencies. Yeah. Okay, you had a second comment also. Could you give your second comment also? Or?
The second comment was. Was this a film, the last one?
No, they're all single crystals.
Also a film?
No, single crystal.
Oh, single crystal.
Yeah. You were going to say that films are no good, right?
No. But films, if you compare dynamic connectivity with aesthetic law, you have to worry, the theoretician has to worry how the limits are perfect and what you really measure. The theoretician has to worry.
Yeah.
On the spectral waves, I mean, where is it gone? Can you do electrosymmetry far beyond 4.5 and to see whether you filter some rules?
No, we can't do that. But what you can try to do is either reflection or transmission experiments at higher frequency. The only problem is that, say, if you the typical synchrotron equipment, you have to go to synchrotron radiation. And as far as I know, nobody has ever tried to do temperature dependence, which is really what we have to do now in a synchrotron. But it is worth trying. You know, it's on my list of things to do.
Semiconductor people do it. I mean, with temperature dependence into 30 AV or something.
I see.
Yeah, for example, Cardona's group. I mean, used to do electrosymmetry and synchrotron radiation to 20-30 electron
volt. Okay. Well, I'll talk to them. I'll talk to them. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. You have to try. Yeah.
Yeah.